morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think we'll kick off. We have two speakers this morning. The session is about tax cases. It's a session directed at analysing tax litigation in a general sense. We have two speakers. Michael Bierman will talk about the different types of cases that can arise where tax issues are litigated, and he'll be followed by Lisa Hesp, who will direct her attention more to Part 4C proceedings, which are the assessment objection procedure. Both of them will be concerned about procedural aspects of conducting the various types of litigation, and they'll also be concerned with the part that the Commissioner's rulings and public statements play in how the litigation is conducted. But the first speaker is Michael, and he will talk about the different types of cases in which tax issues will arise.
Thanks, Greg. If you suddenly hear swearing and screaming from the lectern, I have ripped a muscle in my rotator cuff, I'm advised. And every now and again when I grab something, you'll know about it. Tax cases are different. I'm a lucky person. I started out as a tax lawyer. I've always been a tax lawyer. I've drifted into commercial litigation, and one of the reasons we raise this as a topic is because in the tax world you come across people who aren't specialists from time to time, and they sometimes get into difficulties or express concerns about the way things happen. There are two views in all areas of tax litigation. One is that of the representatives of the taxpayer, and the other is the representative of the tax authorities. This morning I'm really talking about the representatives of the taxpayer and their perspective. The revenue has its own special position, which is to a large extent the converse of what I'm going to discuss. I've put up a slide that says tax cases are different for four reasons. It's a bit hard to read. The first is because of a complex statutory overlay biased in favour of revenue authorities. The purpose of the tax legislation is to impose tax and to cause it to be collected, and there's a lot of talk about tax simplification. And by and large, tax simplification means creating means by which it is more readily collected for the revenue by the revenue authorities. So every dispute with the revenue authority, whether federal or state, is usually about legislation which is intended deliberately to enable the revenue authorities to collect tax. The second point I've made is a bit facetious. It's all been done before. There are, as anybody who practices in tax know, a lot of cases about all of the procedural aspects in the tax areas. Most of the statutory construction type arguments have been run at some stage or another, and you'll find a precedent for almost everything. And I'll give a couple of examples today that where a taxpayer has been immediately successful, the legislation has been immediately amended to plug what was perceived to be a hole. The third reason that tax cases are different is because the motivating factors of the revenue are not commercial motivating factors. One of the most common errors I come across when I'm retained by for people who are commercial, usually commercial, being involved in commercial disputes, is that the suggestion is put up, well, we only have half the money, that's all the assets we have, we'll put it up and they'll do a deal because they can't get blood out of a stone. And that's a common line taken in a commercial negotiation and is often effective because the motivating factor of a party of commercial litigation is usually to do the best they can and to get out. The Commissioner has no fear of litigation. The Commissioner often is not interested in a monetary return. Be interested in making an example, is interested in setting precedents, and most of all, to the last point, is bound by its own rules. So the Commissioner's usually, in any negotiation, discussion or litigation, concerned to ensure that it's operating within its own guidelines. And those guidelines tend to be more important than the fiscal outcome that's to be achieved from the taxpayer's perspective. And hence, in the course of a dispute, which I will consider from effectively the self-assessment stage where a return is lodged all the way through to proceedings under Part 4C of the Tax Administration Act, which Lisa will talk about, those rules. As I said, there's two stages, objection, review and appeal. This is the ultimate place in which every tax dispute ends up. As we'll discuss, the rules force a substantive tax dispute into Federal Part 4C of the Tax Administration Act 1958 in the Commonwealth context, which is the objection and appeal process, and every state has its own equivalent of it. Prior to a dispute getting to that stage, there are many other steps, which I've just called everything else, which I want to talk about. The everything else, there are really three categories. This case is about the process, that is the application of the Commissioner's rules, the way that audits and investigations are conducted, what information and the information gathering processes of the Commissioner, and I think this is really where most of the litigation has ensued in recent times, determining about what the Commissioner can and can't do. The second category I've put is the cases about money. This is the collection process. And as the economy's gone soft, there's been an awful lot of cases and authorities about that. And the third I've mentioned, I won't talk about that much today, cases about criminal jeopardy. I raise it not because we want to talk about criminal aspects of tax today, but because it does inform the way the dispute is operated under cases about money or cases about process. It's the third place, the other place otherwise than a Part 4C appeal where a tax dispute can lead, and it's something I think civil lawyers tend not to think about and commercial lawyers tend not to think about because it doesn't overly affect the practice. But in tax, because of the strict consequences, strict liability and absolute liability consequences that follow, it's something which regard has to be had at all times in the conduct of a case. Process. The Commissioner is a model litigant. In my experience, what representatives of taxpayers consider the obligations of a model litigant to be are different to what the Commissioner considers a model litigant to be. There are promulgated guidelines that can be read. I certainly take the view that the Commissioner should be in the position of a prosecutor. The Commissioner takes the view that he has to behave fairly in accordance with his own guidelines, and they're very, very different things. Particularly when it comes to disclosure and to the way that cases are run, what information is provided in advance. What needs to be understood is how the Commissioner applies the rules, and that will give you boundaries within which litigation can be operated. The second, the administrative obligations. These are the Commissioner's own rulings, the Commissioner's own guidelines, and in practice, from the Commissioner's perspective, these are more important than his obligations under the Act. Not every tax, well, very few tax officers are legally qualified. Many have no accounting qualifications. They've simply been trained internally, and the extent of their information are the internal rules and guidelines which were promulgated to advise them as to what to do, and they will stick to those religiously, and they'll often stick to them even when it's pointed out that it's contrary to a lawful obligation they may have. But it does inform how the Commissioners will think, and it does, that since the rules are all public, there's no excuse for not knowing how it will operate. The third process is legal obligations. I'll come to those, and obviously, as lawyers, we all understand that these will prevail. And an awful lot of dispute and litigation consists of the tension between what the taxpayer's representative and a taxpayer contends the Commissioner is obliged to do as compared to what the Commissioner, in accordance with his internal operation, thinks he must do. These are, by and large, administrative law cases. I'm not going to talk about ADJR. I will make some comments that The commissioner and the state commissioners in every case are given a power of general administration of the legislation. And it is this power that is used to found all of the many things and ways that the various state revenue officers and federal commissioner goes about collecting tax. This general power has to be compared to specific powers in the Act, some of which we'll talk about, powers to assess, powers to exercise anti-avoidance provisions, powers to collect in particular ways. Now, by and large, the more specific the power, the more likely it is that there'll be a form of administrative law that governs its review, and the more general the power, the harder it is to challenge that type of exercise. In the Commonwealth context, there have been quite a number of cases recently under Section 39B of the Judiciary Act seeking injunctions, mandamus, prohibition against the Commissioner exercising general powers, and by and large, I think when we come to privative clauses, you'll see that they fail. Now, every case starts with self-assessment, and these days taxpayers are obliged to work out their own tax affairs and obligations, and at that stage the Commissioner has nothing to do with it otherwise than to accept the filed return. And the method chosen to ensure compliance is that there's a process of investigation and audit. I distinguish between the two. I consider investigations to be quasi-criminal or criminal in nature, and audits to be technical reviews of tax obligations. But in every case, the Commissioner needs information, and the Commissioner will usually commence by a request for information. These requests usually land on the desks of accountants as the day-to-day managers of taxpayers' affairs rather than lawyers' desks. And it's at that time that decisions are taken as to what to disclose or not to disclose to the Commissioner in the way that they're disclosed. The Commissioners did a talk at the bar, Victorian Big Bar Taxpayer Talk, and I was astonished that there were 10 million desk audits last year alone, something like 25,000 full compliance audits and 5,000 actual investigations, and the numbers are large. And in every one of those, what's requested is access to documents. The ones the lawyers tend to get into is when the Commissioner is not satisfied with what has been provided. Often that can be remedied easily. On other occasions, compulsory demands are made. There are various powers of Section 264 of the Income Tax Assessment Act. There's Section 385 to Schedule 1 of the Tax Administration Act. There are state equivalents. And they all require, in one form or another, a document from the Commissioner which compels either the production of documents specified in the notice or attendance for examination on oath. And I consider, in a practical sense, these sorts of notices to be the commencement of hostilities, if you can look at it that way. Taxpayers really have limited rights in respect of these notices. One, of course, they're bound by the terms of the notice, but if the Commissioner gives a notice that says that Mr. So-and-so must attend and give evidence at the office of Mooney Ponds before these officers, well, there's not much that can be done about it. But the limitations are there is no form of compulsory examination in the Tax Act, so I put aside the Criminal Investigatory Powers, the Proceeds of Crimes Act, but under the tax legislation in Australia, there's no form of examination to which legal professional privilege does not, limit. There are accountants' privileges. Legal professional privilege is one of the main areas of litigation in these contexts. They tend to be Judiciary Act cases seeking injunctions against the provision of documents or answering of questions. The usual practice of the Commissioner in contentious cases these days is to retain counsel to ask the questions, and certainly my usual practice in those circumstances for the investigated director or taxpayer to be accompanied by a solicitor or counsel. The role they play is twofold: one, to make sure the questions are fair, and the second is to advise the client as to statements of legal professional privilege. They're usually rare. The Commissioner is usually interested in what happened rather than what advice was given, the exception being where there's allegations of anti-avoidance or tax schemes, in which case the Commissioner often seeks the documents which suggest explain how the transactions are subject to the scheme or to be implemented. Those documents, if they're legal documents, there's usually no difficulty. Privilege can be claimed. There are a number of cases which are about whether privilege should apply, and they're conducted in the same way as every commercial case about legal professional privilege. In tax, and certainly in the Commonwealth sphere, there's what's called an accountant's privilege. The Commissioner of Taxation has promulgated guidelines under which he states that he won't seek anything other than source documents from accountants, at least in the absence of any allegation of evasion or avoidance. So they would be the working papers, they would be the returns, they would be the accounts, but not, for example, the advice that an accountant might have given about the structure of the transaction and the way that the capital gains tax consequences would apply. And these are sort of secondary advice documents. This privilege is granted under the Commissioner's general power of administration and has generally been thought to be not subject to challenge. There's a recent decision of Justice Perham in the Federal Court, the case has just slipped my mind, where the Commissioner didn't follow the process in his own in the rules promulgating the privilege. So he wanted to go behind these rules and seek the documents of the advice the accountant had given, and it went off to the internal review panel that's created by the rules, and the panel ruled without submission from the taxpayer that the documents should be handed over and the Commissioner could have them, and the taxpayer successfully restrained that access on the basis that their legitimate expectation that the rules would be complied with hadn't been followed. Whether that case stands up is an interesting question. More interesting is that the case was originally run, as I understand, on the basis of estoppel. It was alleged that the Commissioner had created or made a representation that hadn't been complied with and there was some form of detriment. The usual rule for estoppel against the Commissioner is there isn't any. There's a Cade Wade in the Commonwealth, which I think is volume 160 of the Commonwealth Law Reports, and there's a throwaway line because there was an attempt to stop an assessment, and what the High Court said was, well, you can't stop the operation of legislation, in that case legislation imposing a tax liability. I've always thought there's a distinction between that and restraining conduct of the Commissioner. If the Commissioner says, if you do this, I'll do that, and we'll do a deal, settles an audit, agrees to settle a dispute. I've always thought that the Commissioner could be bound and estopped in the ordinary way, but I know there are many learned minds who disagree with me on that. Self-incrimination privilege, which comes back to my third point, criminal jeopardy, you have to keep in mind. Surprisingly, self-incrimination is one of the key matters that crosses my desk, even though I'm strictly a civil lawyer. Because of the strict and absolute liabilities in the Tax Act and the Commissioner's most recent attempts, he's most recently been prosecuting under, rather than fraud, obtaining financial advantage by deception. And one has to be very careful when providing the documents on a compulsory basis or under oath that one isn't incriminating, the clients aren't incriminating themselves. There is no exemption from that under the tax examination provisions, and so if one's clients ask the appropriate question, they must answer. And a great deal of what has to be done in that sort of preparation is to know where those risks are and to guide the client accordingly. Position papers and draft position papers. One of the advantages of litigating against the Commissioner is the Commissioner will always tell you what he's going to do and why he's going to do it. And if you ask, you'll always be given the opportunity to comment in advance of the event happening as to what's going to happen. So in an audit context, the Commissioner will always, before issuing an assessment, issue a position paper for you to comment on. This is I don't know, the Commissioner sees it as an advantage for taxpayers, but it really is, because in many instances, the Commissioner will have got the law wrong. The Commissioner will have not considered, staff will have not considered legal issues. An example might be one I had recently where There had been an unenforceable agreement for interest to be imposed on a loan retrospectively when there had been no further consideration, and the Commissioner was assessing the whole of the interest, which was tens of millions of dollars, on an accruals basis, on the basis it had been agreed to be paid and he wanted to bring it into a present year of income. And in that case, my instructors persuaded the auditors that before the final position paper was issued, because there were legal issues involved and the Commissioner might need to take his own advice and respond, that a draft position paper should be issued before the formal position paper was issued. And, of course, the draft didn't include any consideration of legal obligations or entitlements. A detailed response was put in, which I settled, setting out what the law was and how the banking law operated, and the law of contract. And in due course, when the position paper had come out, the Commissioner had resiled from his position that it was accrued and could all be paid today, but to the extent that interest was paid under this agreement, he would assess it as it when it was received. Now, that obviously was a position that was acceptable to my client, but it came about because my instructors had the foresight to engage in discussion with the Commissioner about what the position would be before anything was set in stone. And we've got something to move. To me, this part of the process is the most crucial thing that a litigator can add value on in a dispute with the revenue authorities. It is the position when lawyers can come in and say to the Commissioner's representatives, well, I understand these are your guidelines, but that's contrary to how the contract law works, it's contrary to how the Tax Act works, it's contrary to the law of equity or trusts or whatever it is that causes the underlying obligation to arise. And it's really the first opportunity where the dispute will be fleshed out, and it's the opportunity for lawyers to control, in the first instance, what the dispute will be about. Once the position papers come out and the Commissioner's taken his view, that tends to lead inexorably to what Lisa's going to talk about, and you're bound into the issues that are the subject of the dispute. So the earlier that the lawyer gets involved in that process, the better. Validity of assessments and notices. You're going to talk about privative clauses. I'll skip over privative clauses. There are prima facie evidence certificates. There's a distinction. There are many provisions in the Act which allow the Commissioner to aver or provide a certificate, the existence of which is sufficient to defeat a strikeout application. So in proceedings for debt recovery under the running balance account, the Commissioner will simply have to provide this certificate where he certifies the debt's due and payable, and then it's up to the taxpayer to disprove the correctness of the certificate. There are a few provisions where averments are still around. They're the old form of this. By and large, they've been abrogated. Well, process. I've given some examples of why you might want to challenge and engage in the process. There are many representatives I know who use what I call the scorched earth policy. If the Commissioner investigates, you must respond and you must prevent every step. I think there are strategic advantages. The position paper is one that where lawyers can really add real value. One of the main advantages is, of course, if, for example, something is said to be out of time, the Commissioner has a period of time to amend an assessment and you can suggest the assessment wasn't validly made, you might run a case along those lines to challenge the validity of the assessment. And the real reason, I mean, that underlies most of this is concerns about criminal jeopardy. It's quite common in my practice for a criminal barrister who's experienced in fraud and fraud against the revenue as well as tax matters to be engaged alongside civil counsel and to be brought in as and when needed on these sorts of issues. I'll come to that a bit more at the end. Okay, well, cases about money. Every tax case, when you get through the process, will end up on objection and appeal if it's going to be fought, and that's what Lisa's going to talk about. But in the meantime, one needs to manage what the Commissioner is entitled to hold and take pending that dispute. And in that regard, one needs to be a distinction between what I call final taxes, which are tax imposed upon a particular taxpayer, the income tax, the interest withholding tax. There are the PAYG obligations, which are the ongoing obligation to pay in advance of the tax liability arising, And that includes withholding taxes, but I distinguish them. Withholding taxes being taxes that are collected by one person for and on behalf of another. There are wages, PAYG wages of employees is the most important. Superannuation is another, and there are many smaller circumstances under the Act which are less common. And what I've said is that withholding tax requires stricter compliance. The Commissioner takes a different view in respect of withholding taxes than he does in respect of your own tax obligations. The general rule is that tax is to be paid pending the outcome of a dispute, but that's subject to all sorts of disputes and policies. There used to be a document about 400 pages long called the ATO Receivables Policy, which set out every circumstance in which the Federal Commissioner would govern how tax would be collected in the interim and the end of a dispute. In April, this was divided into a series of about 20 what's called practice statement law administration. There should be in your package a list of every one of these that exists, and I've provided a table that compares the old general receivables policy to what now is the rule. The main ones I'm mentioning is PSLA 2011-14. This is when the Commissioner will defer payments. If your clients need time to pay tax, if they want to pay in instalments, if they want to do a deal, these are the general rules that govern. I need to read these. The Commissioner will make a complete and thorough investigation and require your client to disclose everything about their financial life, everything about their relative's financial life, their related vehicle's financial life, to show how and when and why tax can't be paid on a particular basis and needs to be paid in instalments or otherwise. By and large, the Commissioner will require the realisation of assets, although by and large he'll allow that to be done on otherwise on a fire sale basis. So one can usually do a deal to provide security, for example, whilst the tax is being realised. One of the main exemptions is the 50-50 arrangement, PSLA 14. The general rule of the Commissioner is if a taxpayer is in dispute, wants to take a dispute under Part 4C or has some other issue, the Commissioner will accept a 50% payment of the tax up front and at that time defer further recovery proceedings. There's a major advantage in that process is that the special interest charge, or formerly the general interest charge that's imposed, was effectively halved. And one needs to be really careful about the interest because it's, from memory, about 4% above bank bill rate accruing, and what usually gets taxpayers, or certainly SME taxpayers, into trouble when they have these disputes is the interest. The dispute goes for 4 or 5 years, at the end of which the accrued interest exceeds the original tax and penalty debt, and it can't be paid. I think John Morgan at the bar did a paper a few years ago where he did the calculations and suggested that if a SME was more than three quarters behind, unless their gross income doubled, they could never catch up. So controlling the interest is very important. How these arrangements are going to be entered into is very important. The Commissioner will happily resile from these 50-50 arrangements whenever he perceives a revenue is at risk. So I have a case at the moment which is, I think, pro bono. There's a husband and wife. The husband was a former director of a company involved in wheat and he got himself into trouble with some offshore income. The Commissioner has decided that everything he made was also magically his wife's income at the same time and has assessed them in the alternative. There is only one asset, it's a house and some cash. They have nothing to live on, and what was proffered was actually we would hand over all the cash, which was roughly half the debt, and hang on to the house, and the waiver of the debt would then be used to fund the litigation. And that's been declined. The Commissioner wasn't prepared in circumstances where he perceived there to be conduct that wasn't just a technical conduct, some sort of evasion, to accept that arrangement. And there'll be some litigation about that, because my client's perception is that what the Commissioner's trying to do is bankrupt her so that she can't run the case. Other options, instalments. Well, you can usually do a deal. I mean, unless there's some, the Commissioner has some perception of wrongdoing on your client's behalf, which takes you back to the position papers and how you handle those. The third one is a specific provisions in respect of hardship. and that's what the application will be for this particular client. They can't, they're unemployed, they can no longer live. I should add an entirely different topic. There are hardship waiver provisions. They're in the list of the PSLA, is how the Commission approaches those. For the actual waiver of tax liabilities, they're in the tax Schedule 1 of the Tax Administration Act. It's a reviewable process. If you have a client who is in difficulties and effectively bankrupt and unable to pay the tax, you needn't wait and have that hang over their heads for the rest of their lives, which is what the Commissioner will do. You can make an application to the Treasury to have the tax liability waived. And the decision of the ATO, which is delegated by the Treasury to consider those cases, is a reviewable decision in the AAT in the Federal Court. I'm not aware of any decided cases yet on those provisions, but I'm aware of cases where significant, in consequence of a settlement of an audit that otherwise left an individual taxpayer destitute, I am aware of cases where the Commissioner has waived the balance of the debts and in to the sum of many millions of dollars. So it's a path worth considering. Withholding liabilities. Where there's PAYG or superannuation, the Commissioner considers this to be a statutory trust. And so it comes to a shock to most taxpayers because they pay the net wages and they never had the money representing the superannuation of the PAYG, but the Commissioner considers the Act to apply as if they had that money, they've got the benefit of it, and they're holding it on a trust. I mean, it's not strictly speaking a trust, that's just the approach. The provision, the PSLA, is 2011-18, and it sets out what the Commissioner does to cover those. There are a number of mechanisms. There's garnishees, there's freezing orders, DPOs, we call them, DPNs, and, of course, bankruptcy and insolvency. And for commercial litigators, tends to be a vast amount of work in these areas. The garnishee notices, Commissioner can claim monies from third parties in respect of debts of other parties, is obliged to notify the party in respect to which the debt's been collected, often doesn't, and there are many cases about the strict compliance with these statutory entitlements which the Federal Court insists upon. You know, certainly for a business there's nothing worse than the bank suddenly receiving a notice that all the money coming through is to be paid to the Commissioner, which starves the business of its working capital and the fees it was intended to, or the income it thought it would be receiving. There is a limit for an individual taxpayer. The Commissioner won't seek more than 30% gross of salary and wages. I consider that to be rather a lot. I certainly couldn't live if 30% of my after-tax income was suddenly diverted off to a third party. And the GIC continues to accrue while this happens. And, of course, for most people, that interest will accrue faster than they can pay the debt. Garnishees tend to be negotiable. The Commissioner does recognise the impact that it has, particularly on businesses. The Commission doesn't want to be the one who forces a business into insolvency if it turns out that they were wrong in respect of the debt. There is a fair amount of litigation of that for those reasons. Freezing orders, the Commissioner doesn't resolve from using those either. The case I was talking about with the husband-wife, a freezing order was used to restrain all the assets. They're just Mareeva injunctions. The Commissioner brings them in the ordinary way and they're disputed in the ordinary way. Departure prohibition orders, the Commissioner has special powers to prohibit a person departing Australia who owes a tax debt without his permission. There's a process for permission being sought under the Act and a process for challenging that. In addition, the court itself has power to authorise a person to depart Australia. These can be used maliciously, these sorts of things, particularly if you have clients who are directors of overseas companies or need to be elsewhere. I had one client who was having a tax dispute in Hong Kong as well in Australia about the same income as to... He'd been assessed in both jurisdictions to the same tax, and the Commissioner here played a bit dirty by issuing a DPO, which meant that the client had to go bankrupt in Hong Kong, which maximised the Commissioner's liability of getting the tax out of the same pool of assets in Australia. In that case, a decision was taken not to go to the Federal Court, but there are plenty of decisions about what factors are taken into account by the court and whether someone should be allowed to leave the country. And anyone who's run a bail application will be familiar with those. It's really a question about the risk of the likelihood of return. A DPO ceases to have effect in respect of a bankrupt, and the Bankruptcy Act will prevail, so the trustee would have power to determine whether someone has power to leave the country. Director penalty notices. These, of course, apply to PAYG withheld in respect of tax liability of employees. It's one of the few exceptions in the law where a director of a company outside insolvent trading can be personally liable for an amount. The rules were in 222 AOA to 222 AOJ of the Income Tax Assessment Act 1936. About 3 weeks ago, they were moved to Schedule 1 of the Tax Administration Act 1958 in Division 269. The rules have changed. What's been sought in the move is to fix up all the technical issues that have been proposed to talk about litigation. They don't exist. There's the time for compliance is 14 days to 21 days, and as you may recall, what happens is if a director is personally liable to a penalty at all times when the PAYG liability is extant, one is given a few minutes, I'm running out of time, one is given a few days to comply with a notice saying it'll wind the company up, and that's the Commissioner's position. There were a lot of issues about service, a lot of litigation about when that occurred. There's now specific provisions dealing with it. Bankruptcy and insolvency. Commission treats this on a case-by-case basis, and anyone who's an insolvency liquidator it isn't any different. Criminal jeopardy. My final points. The real issues are false and misleading conduct. Any statement made to the Commissioner that is untrue is a criminal offence. So care needs to be taken by the lawyer as to what they sign and what they draw for a client. There's a recent case where a taxpayer was convicted of defrauding the revenue for signing an objection notice which alleged that he hadn't received income when it was proven that he had and he knew he had, and it was just an objection. The consequences of a conviction can be serious. I have a client who's a US director and missed a tax return. Non-lodgement would mean that he couldn't return to the US and be a director of the company, which is the main source. That's an issue. The ATO always seeks a conviction if he prosecutes, so the trick is to avoid the prosecution, and it's more importantly to avoid the referral to the Director of Public Prosecutions. I've had the flag waved at me, so I'll pass on.